Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, we move on. With his band Culture Club, Boy George dominated the charts in the 1980s and 90s, becoming a flag bearer for self-expression with his fabulous outfits, witty personality and beautiful singing voice. But like so many, he was drawn into the dark world of drug use, which took many years to conquer. However, he managed to carve a new life for himself as a club DJ. He became a Buddhist and he continued his recording and performing career. Well, now he and Culture Club, they've got back together again. They've a new album called Life, and their tour comes here to the Three Arena in Dublin at the end of this month. Well, earlier I spoke to Boy George down the line. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us. Listen, you and Culture Club back together, new album out this week, great single, it's on our RT playlist, and you're coming to the Three Arena. How did that reunion come about, George?
Well, you know, we've kind of toured a lot together over the years, but in terms of making a new record, that was really the thing that, you know, we had to really talk about, because I, you know, when they asked me to tour with them, I was like, well, you know, I love doing the old songs, but I want to add some new songs to our repertoire. And I think a band that doesn't create music is not really a band. So that was really the big challenge, to get them to agree to work on a new record. And, you know, we ended up getting a record deal with BMG, which we weren't expecting. Yeah. So, you know, things are great, you know, and I mean, making music with them is always a unique experience, because what we do together, you know, is so particular to each of our individual personalities.
Absolutely. And just to remind people, George, and we'll start talking later on about you coming to the Three Arena. When and how did you form Culture Club? Go back a bit for me, will you?
Well, the first person I met was Mikey Craig, who's the bass player. I was in a band called Bow Wow Wow for about 3 weeks. It wasn't very long. Blinking, you'd have missed it. Anyway, I was in this band, and they fired me by printing a picture of me in the New Musical Express and saying I'd been fired. So that's how I found out. And Mikey had seen a picture of me and thought I looked rather good. And so he hunted me down. I was DJing in a club called Planet, a new romantic club in London. He came and found me and said, I love the way you look. Can you sing? And I was like, yeah, I can sing. And that's how it began. And then I looked for other people with Mikey. We found John. And then we found Roy was the last one. So, yeah, we really came together to be a band. We weren't mates before. And it was really just me getting thrown out of Bow Wow Wow that, you know, sort of made Mikey sort of look at me and go, oh, he looks like a good front person.
And of course, we're not going to linger in the 80s, but you were massive in the 80s. What, can you remember the first time you did Top of the Pops, for instance?
When we did Top of the Pops, we were very low in the chart. We were sort of in the 40s, and we weren't eligible to do Top of the Pops. But by a chance situation, Elton John, or it was either Elton John or Shaken Stevens, was ill or something, and we got their slot. We got a phone call the night before saying, you know, do you want to do Top of the Pops? And, you know, I'd grown up watching that show. It was all I ever wanted was, I mean, really, that was my kind of career goal, was to get on Top of the Pops. So when we got on there by chance, it was just an amazing, you know, lucky accident. And everything really snowballed from that performance.
And the style, how did you, I mean, you were already dressing up long before you went into a band, weren't you, George?
I was, and in fact, my looks were far more outrageous. You know, I used to run around dressed as a nun, Carmen Miranda, Boadicea. I did it all, and what I did in Culture Club was actually a toned-down version of what I'd been doing in the clubs in the late 70s. And, you know, I had grown up listening to, you know, Bowie, Mark Bowler and the T-Rex, you know, all the glam rockers. So I wanted to be that kind of performer. I wanted to be someone that you wouldn't forget if you saw them, and, you know, to have also have musical credibility as well.
Why did you call yourself Boy George?
When we first started Culture Club, we were taking photos around of the band, and everyone would say, "Who's the girl?" And it just became a kind of running joke. And I was, if I'm honest, going out of my way to look as feminine as I could. I wasn't particularly surprised when people said, "What's her name?" But it became a running joke, and I thought it'd be quite funny if I called myself Boy George, so that there's no confusion, but there's also a little bit more confusion.
At all the singles you sold, I mean, I assume when you go to the Three Arena, George, you will play Carver Chameleon. How did that song come about, and did you know it would be as big as it was, and will you be playing it in the Three Arena?
Oh, if we didn't play that, that'd be a stampede. Well, we will make you wait for it, but no, we do all the hits, we do all the classic songs and a handful of new songs, we do a few covers. But when I wrote that song, when I came up with the idea of Come a Chameleon, everyone in the band ribbed me. They hated it. I had to fight with them to get it on the record. But I knew it was a hit. I didn't know it was going to be number one for 9 weeks. But I knew it was a hit. It was just so repetitive and catchy. And I had to fight to get that on the record.
It was one of the biggest hits ever.
It was. So there you go.
When you look back on those times now, and you look back at the very young George, do you feel happy about those times? Do you look back with fondness? Do you like that 20-year-old George?
You know, there are some parts of me that are very much like that, you know, kid when I was 19. You know, when you get famous, it kind of distorts your idea of yourself. It distorts your idea of reality. And if you're lucky, at some point, you know, you get back to the essence of who you really are. I believe that life is about growing into who you actually are, you know. And if you're lucky, you come back to that person. And a friend of mine said to me very recently, he said, you know, there was a point where you really lost your sense of humour. And he says, now you remind me of that 19-year-old Irish kid that I met, you know, in London, in the club, and that you know, he said, you really remind me of when you were younger. Obviously, I'm much more experienced. I've been through a lot. But in essence, I've always been George O'Dowd, you know, from Eltham.
Which is great. And I was lucky enough about 10 years ago, George, interviewing your mom on my TV chat show. Remind people, and Dinah, your mom, is a fantastic woman, but remind people of your parents' backgrounds. I mean, you had a very Irish upbringing with your mother, didn't you?
I did. Well, my name is George O'Dowd. So in the 70s, I was really made aware of my Irishness at school. You know, there were lots of comments. And not only did I have the Irish heritage, but I was also quite obviously gay. I got a lot of abuse about everything. And I grew up in, you know, an Irish Catholic family in London. My dad's family are from Turles, and my mum is from Dublin. I was born in London, but I was raised very much in a kind of Irish atmosphere, particularly with my father, because, you know, a lot of his family live in London. My mum's family are mostly in Ireland.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I was really aware of being Irish. I grew up listening to, you know, Irish music, especially on Christmas Day. My auntie Kit would say, get out the Reverend songs, you know, put on Kevin Barry. And so, you know, I grew up listening to that stuff and being very aware that I had an Irish heritage, which I've always been very proud of. And I've always thought that my sense of humour comes from my Irishness, you know, my sense of humour and my resilience, you know.
Funny you mentioned Kevin Barry there, because I watched your Who Do You Think You Are recently. And tell us about your uncle, wasn't it? He ended up, was that Thomas Brian? What's his name?
Yeah, my great aunt was married to Thomas Brian. And he was hung by the British in 1922, I think. That week that he was hung, my aunt lost her first child in childbirth. So it was the saddest story to uncover. You know, it was...
Mm-hmm.
And then there were things they didn't put in the show, that my grandfather had to bury his grandson because there was a strike in the cemetery. So, you know, going back into that story was very powerful for me. And, you know, as a kid, I was aware that there was a connection to Kevin Barry because, you know, I knew the song and we used to sing along to it at home. But I never fully knew everything. So doing Who Do You Think You Are was such a revelation to me. And also, you know, I found out stuff about my grandmother, Bridget, who was taken by the Cruelty Men, you know, around about the same time, you know. So, you know, it was really interesting. I mean, I knew when I agreed to do the program that there would be a certain degree of sadness, you know, because Irish history is, you know, made of sadness. There's a lot of sad stories. But there's also a lot of, you know, my grandmother in particular was a triumph, you know, because so many women who went through what she went through, she went in an industrial school when she was 6 years old. And a lot of those women never married. So the fact that my grandmother married my granddad, Frank, and, you know, she's the reason I'm here. So I'm very proud of her. And I knew her obviously very well as a kid. And I loved her dearly. So it was really interesting to find out what made her into the person she was.
Yeah, that was so interesting. And then, interesting, you had another, was a great-grandfather in the British Army. Like, you had a very interesting but mixed history, George.
I did, but, you know, a lot of people at that time, you know, it was called, you know, economic conscription. A lot of people went into the army because that was a way of getting paid. That was a way of surviving. But I don't think that I know that my great-grandfather had a picture of Michael Collins above the fireplace. So I know that in his heart, you know, he was always sure about his Irishness. But, you know, I think it was a question of survival at that time.
You, interestingly, came out really young. Like, that was a courageous thing to do. And were your Irish parents okay about that? I think you were about 15 or 16, were you?
Yeah, I was, I think, 15, and, you know, I'd fallen in love with this friend of mine, and, you know, I, you know, was really heartbroken, and I went to my mother and said, you know, I'm gay, and I went off to stay with my grandmother in Birmingham for a few months, and, you know, that was really, you know, how I told my mother. And my mother was very, I think my mother was very surprised because, not that I was gay, but I think that was kind of obvious, but that I couldn't have told her sooner. You know, it's such a strange thing you know, I remember she said, oh, you've been hiding this from me. And I was like, well, I've been working it out, really. I didn't really know, you know, what I was and what I felt, you know. But, you know, my parents were amazingly supportive to me. In the beginning, it was very much, spare us the details. We don't really want to know about it. But being the kind of kid that I was, you know, I really, really did want them to accept me and to accept who I was and what I was. And, you know, I went out of my way to make that happen, and it did happen, you know. And, you know, my parents were amazing regarding my sexuality.
The victims we know so well, they shine in your eyes when they kiss and tell. Strange places we never see, but you're always there, like a ghost in my dream. And I keep on telling you, please don't do the things you do. When you do those things, pull my puppet strings, have the strangers fight for you. We love and we never tell what places our hearts in the wishing well. Love leads us into the stream, and it sink or swim like it's always been. And I keep on loving you, it's the only thing to do. When the angel sings, there are greater things, can I give them all to you? Ooh. Oh, strings of emotion, take a ride into unknown pleasure. Feel like a child on a dark night, wishing there was some kind of heaven. Oh, I could be warm with you smiling. Hold out your hand for a while. The victims, we know them so well, so well.
And your mom is still doing well?
She's good. She's 80 in January. So we're going to have a big, massive party. And I do believe that she'll be joining me in Dublin for the show.
Oh, great.
She's coming over. Obviously, the family's here. So, yeah, there's been talk about her coming. So that'll be amazing.
And on stage as well, of course, you're going to have, I think, the Thompson Twins, Tom Bailey, aren't you, at the Three Arena when you're coming on the 25th of November?
Yeah. We've done a lot of shows with Tom in the last year. We toured in Australia with him. We just did America with him. You know, he's a lovely chap, and he really gets the crowd going. And it's just a really fun night out. You know, it's really, it's amazing how many hits he has. He has so many hits. Like, relentless.
But you yourself, I think 2015, George, you received the very prestigious Ivor Novello Award from the British Academy of Songwriters, Composers and Authors for your outstanding services to British music. Was that a proud moment for you?
Yes, it was. You know, because, you know, in the 80s, a lot of people used to say that the way I looked and my behaviour kind of got in the way of what I was doing musically. I would argue that the two things are, you know, joined at the hip. You know, I mean, you know, I grew up wanting to be like the people I loved as a kid: David Bowie, Mark Bolan, you know, later on Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan. I wanted to be one of those artists that invested emotionally in what they did. And, you know, I don't think it's acceptable for an artist to rock up on stage in sweatpants and a t-shirt. I grew up with Shirley Bassey. You know, I demand more.
Give me time to realize my crime. Let me love and steal. Inside your eyes,
Buddhism is an important part of your life. Is that correct? I know you're brought up a Catholic, but
I always joke that I'm Buddhist in my aspirations and Catholic in my complications.
Sounds good.
I don't think you ever really, that kind of Catholic upbringing. Although it was very, it wasn't like sort of fire and brimstone for us. You know, we were never forced to believe anything. We were always given freedom to question. And, you know, my mom goes to church religiously and, she has a really strong faith. And she will sometimes say to me, "You're a Catholic," you know, and I'll say, "Oh, yeah, I am, but I'm also a practicing Buddhist. And you don't have to be. Buddhism, it doesn't stop you from being a Catholic.
Yeah. What, like, how, if you were to explain to someone in a sentence what being a Buddhist means to you, or Buddhism, what is it?
Well, Buddhism, everything is Buddhism. Everything good, everything bad. All life is Buddhist. But there are consequences to your actions. So if you're prepared to do certain things, you have to accept that there will be a consequence either way. You know, so what it does is it kind of teaches you to be in control of your life, you know. Mm. In the same way that, you know, recovery, you know, says to you, right, what are you going to do about it? I think Buddhism also says to you, what are you going to do about it? You're in control. You make the choices. So, you know, make good ones.
And like most people in life, you'd had ups and downs. So do you think Buddhism helped you get through difficult times and maybe got you back on the straight and narrow, which you clearly are now?
I think that if I'd known more about Buddhism at the time, I may not have done some of the things that I did.
Your life might have been more boring, though.
Well, I don't know. I think that I went back to Buddhism. I practiced briefly in the 80s and then I kind of drifted away. I went back to Buddhism when I was in a really happy place. You know, I just felt that I was missing something. And I just kept bumping into people that I'd known through Buddhist meetings, that I'd met, you know, through those times. And it just felt like life was pulling me back towards Buddhism. I practiced Japanese Buddhism, which is Nichiren Buddhism. And, you know, I just got pulled back into it. And, you know, I feel like it definitely helps me to center my life and you know, to kind of help you make the right choices.
Yeah, because you sound like you're in a great place. You once said, it made me laugh when I was reading articles for this interview, that you said, "My life hasn't always been a disaster. It's just that when it has, it's been a spectacular disaster." Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, I think that a lot of people, when they talk to me about my career and my life, you know, they forget that most of my life has been incredible. Yeah. I've had incredible opportunities. I've had incredible adventures. You know, I've done incredible things. And, you know, unfortunately, people tend to focus on the downs more than the ups. But, you know, trust me, there's been a lot of joy, and there is a lot of joy.
Yeah, and I can hear that. You also have kind of two careers, don't you? Like, you're a big club DJ as well as your pop career. How do you keep them separate? And, like, for instance, will you be playing Ibiza again this summer, next summer?
I don't think so. No, I think I'm focusing mostly now on, you know, music. And, you know, occasionally I get the odd DJ gig, but I'm not doing it as much as I was. And, you know, my first love is music and, you know, live shows. You know, so that's really what I'm focusing on right now.
Do you like performing as much as ever or more?
More than ever, I think. More than ever, because I feel like I've I've grown into, you know, the kind of performer that I wanted to be 20 years ago, that maybe I didn't have the confidence to be. And what's interesting, you know, because I am someone with a reputation, and it's always fascinating to meet people who think I'm going to be one thing, and I'm not, you know. And there's a sort of joy in surprising people, because, you know, a lot of people who come to our shows, they're not sure what they're going to get. They're not sure what I'm going to be like. You know, will I be arch? Will I be precious? Will I be bitchy? And it's quite fun to surprise people and say, no, I mean, you know, this is who I am now. And I love what I do. I have a lot of gratitude for what I do. And let's have a fun night out, you know.
You also got really healthy and fit. Are you still involved in that metabolic diet? Is that the one you used? Tell my listeners.
I am vegetarian. I eat very clean. I'm not a vegan. I couldn't live in a world without cheese and butter.
You're definitely Irish.
Yeah, with a little bit of soda bread. Oh, jeez. So, yeah, I'm vegetarian, but I'm not vegan. And, you know, I eat very clean. I love food. You couldn't really be Irish and not love food, you know. But I cook, you know. I try to stay as healthy as I can.
Tell us what Patsy Kensit, she had an influence on your album recently, something she said. Was it in a Weight Watchers ad?
No, what it was funny. It's actually really funny. It was when I was doing my album, This Is What I Do, and she was in an advert, and she said, oh, I've got my sparkle back again. And I just thought, what a great line. So I wrote this song called Nice and Slow. And in it, I say, I'm just like Patsy. I got my sparkle back again. you know, these days, literally anything can influence a song, you know. And it really can come from anywhere, you know. And I'm always jotting things down, thinking, oh, that's a great line for a song, you know. I've got to use it, you know. And I have a lot of lyrics I saw, you know, for future kind of recordings or writing sessions. But, yeah, Patsy Kensit.
Finally, George, you sound in a great place. Are you happy, content in your life now?
No, I think I am happy. I think if you'd have asked me that question 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I'd be like, why are you asking me if I'm happy? What a weird question. I mean, I don't think, you know, one of my most favourite people is a guru called Dandi Pandey, and he says, people always say to him, you know, if I meditate for 15 minutes in the morning, will I be happier? And he says, no, make your life meditation. So, you know, really, we're already happy. We just need to work out why and how to stay that way. So I suppose in a funny sort of way, the answer to that is yes.
Well, good. Well, look, George, thanks for taking the time to speak to us this morning. Boy George and Culture Club, the Life Tour with special guest Thompson Twins, Tom Bailey, is going to be at the Three Arena in Dublin on the 25th of November. And your new album called Life is out now. And we're going to end and play a song from that, the title track, Life. And it's actually big on our RT playlist right now. George O'Dowd, thanks very much for chatting to us.
Thanks, darling.
Take care.
Bye.